Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.
Some people's careers start at zero and do nothing but go up. And other people, well, their careers have more of a trajectory like the stock market. Tobias Bakel joins us for this episode of I Should Be Writing.
All right, this is I Should Be Writing, season 17, episode 50. I've done 50 episodes this year. That's mind-blowing.
Well, I should be writing.
And I am so excited because y'all have said you wanted interviews back, and I have my first official interviewee for I Should Be Writing. I got Tobias Bakel, who's been on this show, and I think you've been on Ditch Diggers before, and you're one of those rare writers who wants to help out other people as they go along in their career. And so I supported, still do, Toby's Patreon, and he wrote something last week that just kind of blew my mind, and I thought, well, that's a good time to bring back interviews. So welcome, Toby. I'm really glad you're here. And we get started with news on my end. I've said it in the other stream, and I said it online, but I have not said it in the I Should Be Writing stream, so I'll say it here. My book that has gone untitled for years has a title, the series has a title, and it's got a release date. This is all extremely exciting. My book, Station Eternity, book one of the Midsolar Murders, will be out next fall. So no pre-order yet, but at least it's no longer the Untitled Space Murder book. But I will be looking into getting dust jackets created for those of you who really want the book to be named Untitled Space Murder Book, blatantly stealing from Cameron Hurley, from whom you can buy Lesbians in Space to replace her, which one was it? Stars or Legion cover, I think. But anyway, that's what I've been up to. The writing's going well with my novella project. And that's my only good news. So if y'all have any good news, let me know. And Toby, do you have any good news you want to share? We always try to start it out with some positive news.
An interesting new change in life. I spent a chunk of the semester or the lockdown teaching creative writing there for them because they lost a creative writing professor right at the start of the pandemic. So I've been teaching for a year now, and we kind of took that another step forward. And then we also have a new book that's out at audible.com. So if you're an Audible subscriber, you can get it for free. You don't even have to spend a credit. It's an Audible original, Audible Plus novel, and it's called The Stranger in the Citadel. And I'm really excited about it. It was a lot of fun to write.
Excellent. Yeah, I've been trying to figure out how Audible's making money through that. I guess it drives more people to sign up.
Just kind of like one of those large pot things, you know, like the more content they have that they can advertise that, you know, to try and catch people to come in and be a paid subscriber, the more of an overall pot they have.
Right. Okay. Well, that's awesome. I actually have downloaded it, and it is on my to be listened to list, but I'm very excited about it. So I gave a little bit of a intro already, just saying that you wrote something really, really cool on Patreon. But as an intro, essentially, you were comparing your career to the stock market. And I think that helps out a lot of people who just feel like they're spinning their wheels. Or if they get one win and then don't do well, they think, that was my one chance. So go ahead and tell me what you were, how you go about that stock market metaphor.
Yeah, this is something I talk a lot about when I do workshops or teach or things like that, which is, it's like, you know, trying to wrap your head around progress and where you're at in your career. Because as a writer, you're in your own head and you're in your own career, and it's hard to see what it looks like from the outside. So one of the things you have to remember is that there are setbacks and plateaus and reversals, but it requires you to kind of have some perspective. And so what I started writing about was the fact that, you know, I kind of self-mythologized these five great periods of my career, sort of like five restarts or five reboots, or more closely, I prefer to think of it as a stock market. So there've been five market dips or five depressions in my career. The first one came when I first started, and I was just trying to send stories out, and I was getting form rejections back. So I, you know, I was just getting these, you know, letters that were photocopied back then that would just say, sorry, we don't want your story. You know, try better luck next time. And there was a period where I started to get personalized rejections. I started to get these comments from the actual editors on the other side that were kind of like, close but no cigar, or this was really interesting about the story. I felt like I was progressing. I felt like I was getting really close to this moment of being able to finally sell a story. And then I started getting form rejections again. and it felt utterly dispiriting, you know, because I kind of staked a lot on that idea of there being a clear progression, a clear moment where you can get through the door.
Yeah.
And that fallback really dispirited me. But I'm really stubborn, and I have oppositional defiant disorder, you know, a side effect of being ADD. And so I was kind of like, damn it, I'm just going to keep pushing and make it happen. And, you know, after a while, kind of got back and sold my first few stories, you know, and so that became my second surge, right? Which was, I sold three stories in a row, like within 2 or 3 months of each other. There's this period where I had sold a story to Science Fiction Age, which is a magazine that's no longer around, but was 10 cents a word. It was beyond professional rates at the time, which were 3 cents a word. Yeah, so I was kind of like, oh yeah, I hit the big time, you know, and I made a connection with Scott Edelman, who was the writer, the editor at the time. I won a quarter of the Writers of the Future contest, which I'd been trying to enter every quarter since I discovered it when I was in high school. Like I think 8th grade.
Wow.
And then I sold a story, I don't know why I became the royal we there suddenly.
I wasn't going to say anything.
I'm just that pretentious. I sold a story to Nalo Hopkinson's anthology, Whispers from the Cotton Tree Root. And so it was like bang, bang, bang. And it gave me this feeling of kind of like, I figured it out. I can tell a short story. I'm in, I've done it, you know? There's no looking back. It's just, yeah. Sunshine and happiness from here on out, now that I've cracked the code. And then
I'll never get another rejection.
Like, yeah, I'm done. Rejections are behind me. You know, I've made it. I climbed all the way up to the mountain. I've made it to this place, and now there it is. And what ended up happening was for the next 2 years, I didn't sell a thing.
Ooh.
Now on the outside, what it looked like was those stories didn't come out 3 months right next to each other, even though I sold them 3 months apart, like in this little 3 month period. You know, what happened was those stories came out over a year, right? And then I didn't sell anything for like a year, year and a half, almost 2 years. But to people, it didn't look like that. You know, these three stories came out. I did my stuff. I was moving around, you know, pushing how awesome it was that I sold these three stories. I got into CIFWA, the Science Fiction Writers of America. You know, so that was another big tick box for me. But that 2 years that I didn't sell anything was horrific, because I thought, oh my gosh, like I've completely failed. I've fallen all the way back. I've lost it. Whatever it was, I've lost it. And that 2 years was a real struggle for me, you know, because it just felt like I didn't understand how any of this worked. I thought I did, but I didn't. But what it turned out was that those were the three great stories that were kind of above my ability at the time, almost. You know, I kind of had like a little market peak, and that got me above the minimum quality line, and that got me in. And then I kind of went back to what I was doing normally and was below the line again, but still overall trending upwards as I kept writing stories and not giving up. But it took 2 years to get back to that peak again as a writer, to be able to be selling stuff again. And even when I started to break in after those first three stories, my next couple sales were to online magazines, which at the time in 2002, 2001 were not as prestigious.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of, you know, there were, people may not remember this, but 20 years ago, there were huge debates on blogs about whether or not, you know, and in the field and on panels about whether or not you should ever sell a story to an online magazine, you know, and I thought like, well, you know, they're paying professional rates. They've got some names I like, I'll submit. But yeah, my next couple sales were kind of like less exciting than the sales I, you know, broken in with. And it was kind of bittersweet, those sales, because I felt like, oh no, I wanted to be in this other place. But then I started to sell things again regularly and you know, started to climb back up to where I wanted to be. And things started happening again. I found an agent because some of those three stories got me noticed and nominated for the Campbell Award. And that got an agent to notice me and asked me if I had a novel idea. And I did. So, you know, submitted the novel idea to him, got him, wrote the whole novel and started shopping it around and sold my first novel a few years later. So that was my next big exciting breakthrough, was like selling a novel and getting foreign translation rights for, or, you know, other language translation rights, and selling a second novel and locking it down and getting, you know, some attention for the novel. And then, you know, over time, I you know, sold a 3-book series to Tor and was commissioned to write a Halo novel, and that hit the New York Times bestseller list. So again, you know, felt like everything's looking Toby, you know. And then in 2008, you know, we kind of got some of the sales figures back, and we noticed that like my sales were flat. I earned out, my books were earning, but like I just, each book wouldn't go any higher than the previous one, wouldn't go lower, wouldn't go higher. And so we started looking at ways to change things. I got a heart defect and collapsed, had some really health issues. And so things kind of went back down into kind of a slide, you know. It got harder to sell books. It got harder to kind of get the attention I was hoping for, you know. And then my own health meant I didn't have a lot of energy, you know, to just throw myself at things like I did when I was in my early 20s. And so like there was this like slide, and then, you know, I sold Arctic Rising and Hurricane Fever, and they did kind of really well, and Hollywood came knocking for the first time, and, you know, things were looking Toby again. And, you know, and it just keeps going up and down. You know, I went through a real bad kind of period after that where things didn't work out. And, you know, I left my publisher, I left an agent, and, you know, went through another period in the wilderness, and then, you know, sold The Tangled Lands to Saga Press, and that won a World Fantasy Award. And so, you know, right now I'm kind of in another period of like, you know, things are going really well, but I'm absolutely sure there'll be another period of just, you know, the doldrums. And so I think of it as like a stock market where, you know, you're always kind of, you know, trying to pay attention to what the general pattern is, but there are going to be spikes and dips and crazy oscillations. And so even now when I think of like myself, like, you know, before this last set of novel sales and little successes that make me feel very shiny, I was kind of in a flat period. And even at that dip, you know, I'm so far away from where I was at the very beginning that my, you know, my current dip is, you know, more than I could have imagined achieving when I first started out on this journey. So, you know, it's important to look at the whole thing rather than just like, oh, look, I was there 2 years ago and now I'm, you know, doing this and people aren't returning my phone calls. And just know that, like, you know, there's keeping my head down and doing the work, and that, you know, it comes and goes.
So now that you have been able to look back and see all this in hindsight, how, I know you're thinking when, but I feel terrible saying when, so I'll say if it happens again, how do you think you're going to respond to it? Are you going to, like, you're just going to say, okay, this is what happens, I just keep going, or do you think it's going to be more emotional than that, or do you have a different plan in mind?
Well, one of the things is to focus on the work and why you're in this. I wrote an essay a long time ago about going through one of those periods of burnouts where I took 3 months off, basically, refill the well, so to speak.
Yeah.
At the time, I didn't know what the future was going to look like. I was kind of, getting ready to be in between agents and like I said, you get to this period sometimes where people just aren't jumping on everything you're sending out, and you feel a little bit dispirited. But then the question is, why did you get involved in this in the first place, right? Was it for the attention? Was it for, this idea that you're going to win awards and be shiny? There's this kind of stoicism, like classic stoicism, not like stoicism as being humorless and grunting through life, but stoicism as in, you have to pay attention to what you can control, almost like the alcoholic's prayer, right? Give me the insight to see, what's inside of my control and what is not, let go of what's not and focus on what I can control. And the only thing I can really control is my writing, as in the actual work itself. I can't hold a gun to an editor's head, whether short story or novel or anything, and say, publish this, even as, even after however many novels I've, 12 novels and 80 short stories, I can't, people still feel free to reject me. And that's fine. And so I can't control that. All I can do is try to get better, try to write more interesting stories, and try to make it a process that's healthy and nourishing for myself. And so I focus a lot on trying to craft a life around myself that is sustainable and interesting. And so whenever it gets too much into the grind, there has to be a specific purpose for the grind. Like if it's a money grind, that's fine. I've been there when my kids were recently born and I was like paying off these medical bills from my heart defect and stuff like that. I spent a few years in the grind where it was all the decisions were made primarily towards, can I make money? And I don't regret that because I'm a family man. I have, kids to take care of. But now that we're in a more comfortable place and those debts are paid down, the decisions are what is healthy for me as a person,
right?
And I just kind of done focus on that, find new books to read, new things to get engaged with, and be open to possibilities. And remember that this is creative art, not, widget production.
Yeah.
And so you kind of dive into that and you go, okay, this isn't working. People don't want, like for example, I don't think this is going to happen to me, but if people were to like not want any novels from me ever, what's more important to me, being a novelist or continue to produce interesting stories? Are there other things I can do? Can I get involved in, just writing a lot of short stories, right? Ray Bradbury had a great career doing that, So it's like, you just look for, where things are working and how things are working and kind of roll with it, and pay attention to what you're able to throw yourself into. And so I do a lot of kind of like journaling, like discussions on paper with myself, where I ask myself questions and answer them about, why am I doing this? What would this look like if it were fun, is something I stole from Tim Ferriss. He's kind of like a dude bro out in Silicon Valley. But I think he asks some good questions sometimes about designing your life. And actually there's a really good book out right now called Designing Your Life. And I really responded to that book because it's a set of lessons in that book that I wish I'd been taught, but that I had to earn the hard way throughout life. And I routinely kind of go back to this idea of like, am I in a life that I like? Is this fun? Is this sustainable? Is this nourishing? Or is this tearing me apart? Now you're tearing me apart. Those are really good questions to ask, because if this is unsustainable, that there's a grid matrix I always tell people who are interested in my opinion on like life, which is, if you do something you hate or is grinding you down or that sucks and you're not successful at it, you've got like this 100% fail rate. If you do something you hate and you're, grinding away at it and it's successful, you're then stuck grinding and hating, right? So even if you're successful, you're only 50% successful. Whereas if you do something in a way that's nourishing and fun and that you like, and it's not successful, at least then you're doing something that's nourishing and fun and that you like. And so you're still guaranteed a base level of success no matter what. happens, whatever the outcome is. And if you do that and it's successful, it's like so much better for you. I run into so many people who, you know, are like, you know, oh yeah, I sold a novel by like injecting caffeine into my eyeball and watching 32 different screens and, you know, writing, you know, at 3 a.m. in the morning. And you're like, do you enjoy that? And they're like, no, I'm ready to, you know, I want to kill myself. And you're like, so like maybe try something else. But then they're like, but this is how I became successful, right? So you get locked into that path really easily. And it's hard to deviate off of it because then you fear losing the success you have. And it just sets up like this really negative life trap I see people fall into a lot. So all of this comes back to my kind of like, you know, how do I go through one of those dips, you know, as with as much grace and fun as I can.
Yeah. Yeah, I know somebody who was making a pretty good living on Amazon writing romance, and then she discovered that they wanted quantity over quality, so she dropped her quality and was just writing all the time, and she was very successful. But when I saw her, she had both arms in slings, or splints.
Yes.
And I'm like, is that, I don't want to lose my hands. I don't want carpal tunnel. It just, but you know, that was her decision, but it's, that's what you reminded me of, just how much are you going to, you know, bust it to, and then do you have to keep sustaining it? It's, you know, what does a gear change look like if you insist on that being your career?
The question, is this sustainable, I think is one of the most important questions for humanity on just lots of different axes, you know, not just like environmentally, but just, you know, personally, is this sustainable? I think one of the reasons we're having a lot of soulful reexaminations of life right now after the pandemic was people got a, you know, kind of a taste of, you know, is their life sustainable, you know, when they took an, you know, for some who are lucky enough to be paid while on a lockdown, you know, and for some it's not having to do the long commute. You know, I used to get so much pushback about, you know, talking about American car culture, and I've just seen so many people who wouldn't even use the phrase car culture suddenly examining commuting culture online and going like, oh my god, like am I really gonna have to go back to like an hour and a half each way in a car to have this job? Or like, you know, would it be more sustainable for me if I just like, you know, got a lesser paying job that's only 15 minutes away? You know, people are starting to kind of examine these things. And I think it's important. It's like metacognition. When you can have that as an artist, it really helps you out, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So here's a question that I've been wondering about with regards to like podcasting and streaming, but it's still a creative thing. How do you know when you're on a plateau and all you need to keep doing is what you're doing, or instead of a plateau, you're at a wall and you need to change something in order to keep going?
That's a really good question. I don't know if I have a good answer to that.
Yeah.
I know that like when I read people who are involved in coaching and physical discipline, sports and things like that, there's this idea that a plateau means you're not advancing, but a plateau is often when you're banking the fundamentals of that stretch. And so like we're taught to be really impatient about plateaus, but plateaus are often where you're learning what you need in order to make the next big leap. And so when you look at a plateau from that perspective, they become a little less scary, right? This is a time of practice and repetition and mastery that enables me to build the foundation to head up the mountain further. But then your question is, you know, what if you're actually just becoming stagnant? And that's a really good question. I don't necessarily have good ways to tell if you're hitting a wall or in a plateau. But one of the things I do to make sure I'm not sticking myself in a plateau is whenever I hit what I perceive to be a plateau. And for me, that's I look back at work I wrote 6 months ago, because that I have enough perspective after 6 months to judge myself, I think, you know, a little bit more than when I've just turned something in. Whenever I turn something in recently, I'm always just like, it was genius. It's the best thing I've ever done. You know,
and exactly.
Then, yeah, exactly. And 6 months later, I have a little bit more perspective. And what I do is I look back on stuff from 6 months to a year ago. And if I can see progress, then I know I'm kind of making progress. But if I don't see progress, then I know I'm in a plateau. And then what what you can do is you begin to put yourself back into sort of the student mind, right? You start to go like, okay, I've been in a plateau for a year, you know, and it's not a bad plateau. I'm selling work. I'm doing the things I love, but do I want to get better? Yeah. So I need to engage student mindset, which means, you know, going and grabbing books that I really admire and dissecting them to look for things to learn that I may not have, you know, learned when I read them 5 years ago, because I was in a different state of learning. I continually stock up on books about craft from all kinds of different places. And that's a place and time where you can kind of take your hand, or not hand, but take your foot off the accelerator and focus more on digging in and learning. And so whenever I'm going through those plateaus, that's what I do. Or I start to incorporate things that are different. So let's write literary fiction for a few months. Let's write poetry. Let's read in an entirely different genre. Let's start doing experiments with fiction. Let's start doing stuff like that. And those are all things that can help kind of refill the base, you know, to get you to think differently and play around with stuff like that. So that's kind of how I approach it. Whenever I see a stagnation, I kind of start going into that student mindset and looking to learn from others. Sometimes it includes, you know, taking some classes or watching some classes on YouTube, things like that, you know, just mm-hmm. so you kind of go back to, okay, you know, I'm going to learn from someone else, basically, is the leap. You know, you say like, over the next 3 months, that's my mode. My mode is not trying to create great things. It's trying to learn something new from someone. And then that's just it's a filter, you know, that changes the way you go looking for things to do and read.
Okay. Interesting. I really like that. Thank you. I did get a question via email that okay. I wanted to address because it's a really good question. But I will tell the chat that Toby's done a lot of really great open writing about dealing with ADHD. And I know it's something that I deal with and a lot of people in the chat have brought up. So if you have any questions about that or anything he's been talking about, please bring it up because now's a good time to do it. I just got to find that email. Books about craft are my addiction, says Fire Writer. I will never manage to read them all, but I love them anyway. You actually kickstarted a book on craft, didn't you, Toby?
I did. Although it's not as crafty as people would like. It's more just sort of like mindset as well as like my life, because I think right. writing advice is so subjective that
yes.
it really helps to contextualize where the writer's coming from. So I wrote a book called It's All Just a Draft, which is one of my mantras, which is, you know, don't worry about it too much. It's all just a draft, right? It's a story of like how I became a writer, basically. It starts with me in, you know, middle schoolish and works my way all the way up through selling my first novels. And it just includes a lot of matter from that period of what I was thinking about craft and how I approached it and how I approached being a writer and things like that. So hopefully it's enough context that people understand why I make the suggestions I do and don't take them as like, you know, ironclad rules of any sort, which is always what terrifies me.
Yeah. I try very hard to basically say, look, as long as you're getting writing done, you don't need to worry about anybody's advice. If advice doesn't work for you, don't take it as gospel.
That's why it's all just a draft. Exactly. I think like most craft is just a way for us to get from a blank page to something that we can look at and show people, you know, because that's where the real work begins in a lot of cases. And so, you know, reminding myself that it's just, these are just tools to get us from nothing to something kind of helps me, you know, not panic too much about whether or not, am I doing the right craft thing here? You know, right. It's just like, you're creating something from nothing. Relax, dude.
So I found the question and, it's from Chris. I'm a baby writer, but I'm at the point where I'm ready to send out query letters. But I don't have any connections with anyone I'm querying. COVID put a pretty big damper on my con attendance, and I have no idea which bars the agents go to. Is it okay to send out cold queries to agents, or should I wait until I'm able to hang out and meet more people in the industry? Now, first thing I want to do is apologize, because while I do speak about the power of networking at cons, because it's helped my career greatly, by no means do you have to do it. I sort of see it as, there's a person over there who's 6'10". They're gonna have an extra oomph when it comes to playing basketball. Is there somebody who's 6 feet tall? 5'3"? Can they play basketball? Yes, of course they can. I'm from North Carolina. Muggsy Bogues was one of my favorite basketball players of all times, 5'3". And, I never want to tell you guys you have to. Can it help your career? Sure. But no agent is only going to be looking at something that... Wait, there's too many negatives there. An agent's not going to require you to have met them in person or anything. Most people don't get a chance to go to cons, and they build their writing careers just fine. As I've seen you at several cons, Toby, do you have anything to add to that?
Absolutely. I agree with you 100% on that. So, you know, the networking, if it comes naturally to you and it's fun, look at networking not so much. For me, I look at networking not as networking. It's a way for me to gather information. And most of the people that I quote unquote have networked with were people that we were all nobodies. We just happened to be at the convention together, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, people are like, oh my gosh, you know so and so. And I'm like, yeah, well, we met at a bar in a corner when we were nobodies, and we saw each other saying something and thought that was really clever and decided to hang out. Mm-hmm. You know, I just go to meet people and learn about the publishing industry. You know, when I would run into agents, I usually just was like, oh, great, I can pick their brain to understand how it all works, not this person might look closer at my manuscript. The way I got my last agent is completely by cold querying. And some people are like, wow, you've got all these novels and you did that. And it was like, yeah, actually, the first few agents I had were all kind of random personal connections and things like that. But my last agent, I mean, there's a small personal connection in that she was the agent for a good friend of mine. But what I did was I went to Publishers Marketplace and basically read everything I could about all the different agents. And I created a spreadsheet out of 10 years of sales data that they have there for my own purposes. Their Publishers Marketplace. God. I don't share this. But because I hated the formatting, wow, it was just like all the text stuff. So I scraped it all, put it into an Excel spreadsheet, created a 10-year Excel spreadsheet, so I could make pivot tables and all that good stuff out of all the data. Because I was just curious, like, what are the sales records of each agent? You know, they give you some rough dollar amounts, kind of. And I was just curious to run the data, you know, and figure out, you know, which agents sold what to who and how often and what patterns there were to be found. I love studying stuff like that. So I scraped all that data, and out of that, I created a list of, 30 agents that I was really interested in submitting my work to. And I had kind of like a top five, like any of these top five that I have after having done all this research would be really cool. And so I sent out to everybody on that list and had a lot of discussions and stuff like that. My current agent was one of my top fives. And I'd never talked to her. I'd never pitched her. I'd never done anything like that. And I didn't really like lean on my friendship to say like, oh, you should, you know, put in a good word for me. It was just like, oh yeah, she's going to get one of these as well. You know, and she picked it up out of the slush, and literally I ended up in her slush filter because I submitted it to her regular thing. I didn't even ask my friend to give me the real address, email address. I just sent it to what on her website was her formal address for queries. She was actually a little bit behind on checking her queries. And so she got back to me, you know, a few weeks later and went, "Oh my God, are you still talking to agents?" And I was like, yes, I am. And she was like, "Great, let's have a discussion." So it was just, I did the work, right? So cold querying, you know, there were several agents I talked to who I had no personal connection to, had never met in a bar, and some of whom had never heard of me. So it's just a case of just going like, here's this interesting new novel I've written. Here's my career. Here's the, you know, what I've achieved. And would you be interested in having a conversation? So yeah, cold querying is just fine. You don't have to go handshake and network with people in order to get them to pay attention. The work should, you know, catch their eye.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I gotta ask, why didn't you ask, I mean, you know so many writers, why didn't you ask them, who they were represented by, or how they worked with them, or anything?
Oh, I did a lot of that, too, yeah.
Oh, okay.
That all went into my research. Like, when I say I researched, like, you know, it was I wanted to see the money amounts, but the reason I didn't put too much of an emphasis on that is that, I want to say this in a way that I'm not upsetting anyone. I love you all writers, and I love my fellow writers, but some of you just do not have business sense for spots. And so sometimes there'd be people that were like, "Oh, I love this person, you know, or I love this individual." And I'd be like, I know actively that agent would not work for me.
Right.
And that would actually be a dangerous, working relationship. I'm not trying to like slag on agents, but it's just one of those things where it's complicated. And so I wanted that personal thing out of it. Because sometimes I'd be like, yes, that, you know, you love that, you love your agent, but like that agent hasn't really done anything for you, have they?
Yeah.
Or I think that agent is holding your career back, but I'm not going to have that conversation with someone because that's rude.
Right.
You know, so you just keep that opinion to yourself. I didn't want that, you know, I didn't want someone like selling me the idea of their agent and getting me to fall in love with the idea of it when I could see on the Excel spreadsheet some signs that indicated to me that that would not be a good agent for me. And so, yeah, that was that stuff. But I am plugged into the rumor mill, and I know what is, you know, some of what's going on. And so, I knew some agents were off my list just because it's like, nope, not going to do that because of X, Y, Z reason. You know, we don't need to get into any of that stuff, but it's just like, no, that's not a good fit.
Right.
And in some cases I would double check and be like, you know, hey, I've heard this. Is that true? You know, and you just kind of, you know, back channel to an author friend or something like that. But most of it was just me running the data and then having really good interviews and asking a lot of questions of the agent if they were interested in me, to see if I could find someone who had that same sharkish business sensibility that I was looking for.
Yeah. Man, I wish I'd talked to you about this in November when I was doing my agent hunt. Not that I'm disappointed with who I landed with. It's just like I did not do most of what you just said. So,
well, I didn't for my first agents either. So I just, for me, it was kind of like, this is an interesting opportunity to really do a really deep dive into what it is I want out of an agent.
Yeah.
And what is it I think I need to take my career to the next level.
Right.
And so, yeah, it was that kind of, you know, process.
Right. Toby, can you give us your information on how to find you online, and that stuff will be in the show notes as well.
Sure. You can find me online at www.tobiasbuckel.com. And I'm on Twitter as @TobiasBuckel. And that should get you everywhere you need to be.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for listening to I Should Be Writing. If you would like to hear the extended version of this episode, you can support a Patreon for as little as a dollar at patreon.com/mightymer, or you could just come hang out with us on Twitch, where we will keep going with this conversation. You can learn more about me and my books and my podcasts at merverse.com. You can email me your questions about writing at mightymer@gmail.com. My socials are Twitter, mightymer, Instagram when I remember to put something up, and that's MightyMer2. And you can catch this show and my other streams live on Twitch, twitch.tv/MightyMer. Thank you to John Anilio for the use of his song, I Should Be Writing. And thank you to Summer Brooks for the awesome production she gives. So that's it for me. I'll see you next time. And until then, you should be writing.
I do this to myself.
This podcast is brought to you by my Patreon supporters. If you would also like to join the Ink-Stained Fabulists, go to patreon.com/MightyMer.
On that shelf, on the spine of a paperback. A paperback.